Well, good afternoon, KGNU listeners. This is Joe Ritchie. It's a pleasure today to host Sonali Kolhatkar, and she is with Rising Up with Sonali. We hear this every Wednesday during this time slot, and today we're coming on with Sonali to learn a little bit about her. First off, in full disclosure, this is Joe Ritchie. I'm not normally on this time of day, but I produce a monthly edition of Hemispheres for KGNU, and I do help run a nonprofit media organization also called Rise Up, which produces David Barsamian's alternative radio. So in this way, Sonali, I feel like you're a sister to me, and we've grown up around all this media together, but I'm meeting you now for the first time, and reading the thumbnail bio I was provided, they're always incomplete. And I'm realizing now how little our listeners really know about you and about some of the conversions or conversion stories in your past. I've been particularly interested during the pandemic with people who make 90-degree turns and 180-degree turns. And I think you might have something to share in that regard. But yeah, Sonali, you were born in Dubai, and then what happened?
I was born to Indian citizens who had emigrated to Dubai, the United Arab Emirates. I was born and raised there, and at the age of 16, I graduated early from high school, and I moved to the United States to attend the University of Texas at Austin as an undergraduate in physics. I wanted to be a physicist, and I ended up spending 5 years there with 2 degrees in physics and 1 in astronomy, and went on to go to graduate school at the University of Hawaii, where I got a master's in astrophysics, and then moved to Pasadena a couple of years after that and began working at Caltech, and then eventually left Caltech and became a journalist.
Okay, what happened? What
that's
happened?
A thumbnail.
What happened at Caltech? What inspired this? Was it the pay grade? You saw you could make so much more capital working as a freelance journalist?
No, I took a massive pay cut. I had a moment of epiphany. I actually have a TEDx talk about it. If people Google my name and the word TEDx, there's a whole talk that I gave about my journey from astronomy to radio. And the gist of it was that I became an activist and I started working in particular with Afghan women feminists who were working in unimaginable conditions. And it made me think about the privilege that I had, the opportunities that I had that I was not using. And, you know, instead of sitting behind a computer working for a NASA project at Caltech, I could be doing something more meaningful. And a friend of mine suggested that I should try out for a host position at KPFK, our local Pacifica radio station in Los Angeles, where I live. And because she had heard me speak about Afghanistan, so she thought I knew how to, you know, speak eloquently on a microphone. And to make a long story short, I ended up at KPFK as their morning drive time host, which I never expected to do. And I sort of learned on the job and became a journalist. And that was, you know, all the way back in 2002. I've been at it for more than 2 decades now. And and a few years after I started there, I did write a book about Afghanistan. That was my first book. And this is my second book that we're here to discuss, which is, you know, a very different topic, but that's the nutshell journey.
Yeah, the first book did notice that our director at Alternative Radio has a foreword to the book.
Yes.
But it does seem like a very significant experience for you being with the Afghani women and how helped you make this decision in your life.
Yes. I mean, RAWA, the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan, was the organization. They're still around. I still work with them. I helped to found this nonprofit organization called the Afghan Women's Mission. And I still support RAWA. I still, you know, find ways to raise money for them. They are a feminist organization that believes in nonviolent democratic secularism. And, you know, I help raise money and for them to start schools or to fund schools and training programs for women and girls and young boys as well. And they have taught me a lot over the years. And yes, David Barsamian wrote the foreword to my first book that I co-wrote with my partner, Jim Ingalls. Dave has always been a great supporter of our work, and he, you know, knew so much about Afghanistan as well. So it was a natural fit. But yeah, it's that was the start of the print journalism work the journey that I began.
We're speaking with Sonali Kolhatkar from Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm Joe Ritchie. Sonali, that first book, 2006, a debut into print media, not print media, but in book publishing. You've now found another publisher with City Lights and the Open Media series. The new book, we have it here in the studio, by the way, for those of you who want to pick up a copy, just become a new member and come down and browse and see what we have. But you could pick up Sonali's new one, Rising Up, The Power of Narrative in Pursuing Racial Justice, from City Lights Books. Congratulations on this one. This book is largely about the gender and color imbalance throughout newsrooms and in the entertainment and news industries here in the United States. And Sonali has chronicled, well, most of your journalism. This book is copiously footnoted with citations that pretty much chronicle a lot of, I could tell you, sort of cherry-picked some of the reporting you've done over many years to watch these trends in news. But what brought about wanting to get this one out at this time?
So I had another sort of change in a career, not exactly career change, but a pivot. In 2021, I left KPFK. Although KPFK still airs my weekly program, I'm no longer employed. I was a full-time producer and radio host at KPFK, doing a daily program. Rising Up used to be a one-hour daily program. I transitioned it to a weekly show. I quit KPFK. And one of the reasons why I quit it was that I felt like my journalism was fueling a lot of cynicism and hopelessness. I felt like covering the crises, the doom and gloom cycle. Unfortunately, on the left, we're kind of addicted to seeing how bad things are. And then, our response to the awful things that are happening in the world, the injustices of the world, is, well, what do you expect? And what can you do? And that's how, things are terrible. And I cut a job instead, Yes Magazine, which is a solutions journalism outlet. It is a print and digital media outlet, and I'm the racial justice and civil liberties editor. I continue doing my weekly show, and it is right now a project of Yes. We're going to be doing some Yes-related branding. But that's where this book sort of was born, which is to say that although the book is a critique of mass media, both news media and pop culture, what it really also most importantly tries to do is shows how people are taking back the narrative on race and are changing it and are shifting our culture. And so what I mean by narrative is intentional storytelling. And that's what I'm a journalist. I'm a storyteller. I believe very strongly in the ethics and tenets of journalism, which is that we have to uplift those people who are ignored. We have to critique elites. We have to, comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable, as the saying goes. And we have to make clear that there's no such thing as objectivity either, because we all must be biased towards democracy, human rights, social justice. Otherwise, what's the point of being a journalist? If you're going to be on the side of those who already have power, you're just doing PR for the powerful. And that's not a very meaningful vocation. So what I wanted to do was write a book that, first of all, identified that we are steeped in narratives. And we, everywhere we turn, we see internalized narratives, and then they shape our internalized narratives. From the newspapers we read, the books we read, the TV shows and the movies we watch, the interactions we have on social media, the college courses we might have been exposed to as young people, and the conversations we have with our neighbors and our family members. There is storytelling happening all the time in terms of how we view our world. And unfortunately, because we live in a country that was built on white supremacist foundations, on the enslavement of Africans, on the genocide and erasure of Indigenous Americans. And we've never truly reconciled that. We've never really faced it in a serious way. Though that white supremacy remains the default in our media, remains the overarching trend in the narratives that we're exposed to. So that's what I try to identify. And I want our readers, the readers of my book, to identify those narratives and then really become engaged in seeing how those narratives are shifting and maybe how they can get involved in doing narrative shifting. Because if we don't change our culture away from a white supremacist culture into one that uplifts racial justice, policies such as the one that the Supreme Court just handed down on affirmative action will not stick. Our policies will go backward, and we need to move forward into a multiracial democracy, which is what, you know, we are trying to be, but not quite succeeding, right? We're going to be a majority-minority nation in just a few decades, and we are failing to keep to the promise of a multiracial democracy.
Well, in the book, Rising Up, you cite many examples of major media making racial faux pas or just perpetuating racist narratives, classically on the right-wing radio dial. But also you've mentioned things in the National Geographic, LA Times, Kansas City Star, around the country. There have been these heinous examples that you point out, some of the more pungent ones. But you also say that some of these same media have begun to reform or apologize or try to make good on the errors of the past. Have you seen that trending? And so much of what we do on the air seems like homeopathic change. We put it out there. We think it's going to work. Have you seen any change really over the last few years here in the media landscape?
Well, I want to point out that, you know, I call out the right-wing media, but then I also call out the right-wing's favorite bogeyman, which is the so-called liberal media or the corporate media. And I point out that, you know, while outlets like Fox News may be straight up promoting fascism, outlets like the New York Times and CNN are not doing what they need to do to challenge that slide toward fascism. And they are basically attached to the status quo. It took them far too long to identify Donald Trump as a racist, even though he made very clear that he was one right from the outset. And so they are part of the problem. And yes, in especially after the mass uprisings in the summer of 2020, the historic racial justice uprising, the likes of which this country has never seen before, many of these newspapers looked back and interrogated their past and apologized. The Kansas City Star News, as you put out, as you point out, had, I think, the best apology, and they actually pledged to do better. The LA Times apologized. The National Geographic didn't exactly apologize. They did admit to having racist coverage, and they wanted to do better, but they actually never said they were sorry. And it still remains to be seen whether these newspapers are indeed doing better. You know, maybe they are treating Donald Trump with a little bit more of the disdain that he deserves. But they still, you know, they, for example, they did an about face on the idea of Black Lives Matter because, you know, it took them too long to admit that Black Lives Mattered. They finally did when masses of people came out on the streets. But then the main ask of Black Lives Matter, one of the concrete asks was defund the police. By which Black Lives Matter very clearly meant move money out of policing and into the things that actually keep us safe. And the corporate media failed in properly covering that, failed to, give it a serious discussion, and instead, turned it into if we don't have police, then we're just asking for crime to run rampant, and really misunderstood the whole premise, which I think did a disservice and shows that they will not do the right thing unless they are pushed. And so my other chapter in my book, after I cover the corporate media's flaws, is how the independent media, you and I and the outlets we write for and work for and broadcast on, have been the institution and the force pushing the corporate media every step of the way to do the right thing. We understood what Black Lives Matter meant in 2014 when the founders of that movement started saying those words. because we understood that they didn't mean Black Lives Matter more than everybody else. They meant Black Lives haven't mattered to the country and they need to matter as much as everyone else. And we were ahead of the curve. We were ahead of the curve during the civil rights movement. The institutions that are the history, like Pacifica, right? They were, you know, Martin Luther King was seen as too radical by the contemporary news media of his time. And we've seen then, you know, in hindsight, the corporate media catch up. And the same continues today. If it isn't for independent outlets pushing the envelope, pushing the edge, and challenging corporate media time and again, and finding that we are on the right side of history, the corporate media will not live up to their stated ideals of journalism. And that's what, you know, that, and that's, so we build those, we uplift the racial justice narratives that communities of color are putting out, and we push them against the corporate media. These days with social media, people don't even need independent media as much as they used to, and they're doing it on their own. But then, of course, Elon Musk can come and take it all away. So we still need social independent media.
What I loved hearing about from the top of your comment there was the confidence you seem to have about the inevitability of real change happening, given the demographic inevitability of we'll be a minority, multiracial nation in a matter of decades, that there are movements afoot to reform everything from prisons to the healthcare system to the media landscape. I wondered if we could think a little quixotically, a little utopian visioning here for a moment in the not too distant future, what the newsrooms will look like. Will Sonali Kolhatkar be a common kitchen sink name as much as Hannity and Carlson? I want to hear what some of the newsrooms are looking like.
No, I don't think that'll happen. And that's not my goal anyway, right? Like, because independent journalists are out there pushing ideas and not people, we are motivated by values and ideas. And so I would really rather not me be the household name, but the ideas that I'm pushing, if defund the police becomes something that that is something that is widely and properly understood by the majority of Americans, if reparations for Black Americans becomes an accepted understanding of how we move past and move through the racist history of this country, then I will have succeeded. Then you and I will have succeeded, right? If abolitionist views on policing become more acceptable and police brutality and racist policing becomes less and less acceptable, that's when we have won. That's what my future, you know, vision of success and victory looks like. And that comes when our newsrooms are more diverse. And I don't mean tokenism. I mean bringing on young journalists of color who live the reality every single day of what it's like to have inequality in their communities and defunded libraries and schools, and know how to report from the grassroots and the ground up. And then we will start to see these narratives being shifted. So if narrative shifting actually happens to uphold racial justice, I will feel like I played a role in that. And I'll, you know, I will feel like my life has had meaning.
Yeah, well, your life can have meaning too today by contributing to this effort here at KGNU by calling us 303-449-4885. This effort is national. We're just a little station in Boulder and Denver and with a big transmitter. But around the country, grassroots media needs your support. Independent media needs your support. This is how it happens, little by little. And so we got to see our phones light up today. We have volunteers on hand. There are some wonderful thank you gifts, including rising up the power of narrative in pursuing racial justice. Sonali, in the book, the second half, where you look at what some of the new narrative shifts might look like, what kind of stories are you seeing that will be coming in the future if/when we have this change in a more colorful newsroom, let's say? What is the shift that we need to make from who, what, where, when, inverted pyramid? Right. What kind of story, what kind of narratives are you aiming for?
So we can look at a contemporary example and envision how coverage might be different, right? Recently, we heard about a tiny submersible called the Titan with five very wealthy people who went down to look at the wreckage of the Titanic, and the news media gave it such inordinate coverage. It's still giving it so much coverage. And the news media pushes the agenda because you have the U.S. Coast Guard out there expending public resources to like investigate what happened, why it happened. We all know why it happened. We know that a CEO of a, you know, a company, a for-profit company, cut corners, bought discount carbon fiber that was not intended to be pressurized at 10,000 feet below water, and it imploded, and he ignored his own people and the safety regulations. His peers in the field warned him against it. Yet the U.S. Coast Guard is devoting all these resources first to, of course, find the wreckage when they thought that the, or find the submersible when they thought that it was still lost and around, and then to find the remains of the lives that were lost, and then to figure out why it happened. And meanwhile, of course, we had this boatload of refugees fleeing their various nations, war-torn nations that were lost in the Mediterranean Sea, and their boats sank and hundreds of people died, and we will never know their names, their faces. And in my perfect world, the story of the refugees fleeing would have been front and center in a way that would have then pressured governments of various neighboring countries to actually take more seriously the lives of these brown and black people. And there would have been maybe a footnote about the Titan and about these billionaires who we deify and uplift as put on pedestals. They would be seen as ridiculous as they are, and they would be seen as grifters and a burden to society, which they are. And that would be what I would love to have, to see in a future where our news media shift our priorities. But the reason, we have to talk about economics too, right? The reason corporate media chase after these stories is because they are profit driven. They're driven by clicks. They're click chasers. They are driven by ratings. And they want us to feel what it's like to be sitting in a tiny metal tube at the bottom of the ocean, and they want us to identify with billionaires and not refugees, because they think that that is more exciting, sexy news than a depressing story about a family fleeing war. So if we want to change that, if we want to turn it over on its head so that we have more diverse newsrooms and newsrooms whose stories are not based on the number of clicks they can get, we need to uphold racial justice and economic justice, and we need to change the ways in which newsrooms are run and newspapers and news media are run, take out the profit basis and the corporate model and the white supremacist infections, of our newsrooms, and have those newsrooms reflect the plurality of our diversity. That's how it happens. Mm-hmm.
Your example points to sort of the sycophancy for the rich here in the United States that's emphasized and repeated in our media. That's sort of a big Roman numeral, sycophancy for the rich, that is repeated. I'm wondering if you've identified any other Roman numeral type categories for what major media is doing to us on a regular basis.
By the way, my follow-up book that I'm hoping to work on will be about economic justice narratives, because that's an issue, first, that has so much overlap with racial justice anyway, but it's an issue that's dear to my heart. But the corporate media just, it turns us into, it helps buttress the story of the right. And by what I mean by that is that the story that frames right-wing attitudes and the fascism that we're sliding towards is a story of a nation that was, built from the ground up by white settlers, pulling themselves up by their bootstraps, and now it's all being threatened by the hordes of illegal brown people that are coming across our border, and then the black folks that are demanding extra, special treatment and trying to cut in line ahead of us, and we have to uphold this nation for ourselves. And no, you can't have free healthcare because my taxes won't go and pay for your free healthcare, even if I have to deny myself free healthcare because I don't want to pay for your free healthcare because, this is the resources that we're struggling over. That's the story. And every policy, agenda, item that the right wing upholds fits into that story. And the corporate media and the right wing media continue to uphold that story in different ways, right? The right wing media started calling Social Security and Medicare entitlement programs rather than earned benefits, entitlement programs. And the corporate media, so-called liberal media, uncritically repeat that language. So they too are part of the problem. You know, so I think that's the big picture of what I think we should take away from how our minds get shaped, whether we watch Fox News or read the New York Times or watch CNN. We end up on the right side of the spectrum. Either it's far right or it's center right. And that's as far as those media outlets will go, unless they're pushed really hard by those of us in independent media and pulled toward values of justice.
It sounds like what you're identifying is this a characteristic of the slide to fascism, with a fascination with a mythologized past. I'm looking for these Roman numeral characteristics of the media, and there's one. In addition to the false equivalencies is what I'm hearing a lot of now. False equivalencies between criminal charges between Hunter Biden and the whole crew of criminals who worked in the Trump administration. This is another real common one. And I wanted to play this one quickie for you from a Hannity broadcast. Much like Jeff Cohen and some other media critics, we expose ourselves, or we try to expose some of the vagaries of right-wing media by listening to it. This is a clip that is an example of these false equivalencies. Here's Mr. Hannity.
A topic A issue today, which would be about the rumors of indictments for not only President Trump related to the Mar-a-Lago raid and documents issued, classified top secret documents. This is not going to be about top secret classified documents found at Mar-a-Lago, because there's no way that this special counsel can justify charging Donald Trump for that which Hillary Clinton, we know, did herself.
Okay, there we go. Exhibit A.
Look, honestly, I don't think it's valuable to give credence to these, you know, hysterics that that Fox News and Sean Hannity get into. What I have, you know, really tried to start doing with my journalism is, when I cover a story, what is it that I'm trying to accomplish with my audience? Am I trying to accomplish the thing that they already know, which is they're wrong, we're right, which just gets us to dig our heels in more? Or am I trying to point out how the country is going to move past the Sean Hannitys and the Donald Trumps? It already is. And how do we crowd out the voices of the Sean Hannitys and the Donald Trumps with all of the noise that they're trying to make? Because this is what they're trying to fill the noise, right? So while they're talking about all of these issues about Hillary Clinton and Trump's indictment, which are, you know, I follow these news stories, but try not to get too caught up in the details of them. But while they're covering them, they're not covering all of the other issues about how student debt is burdening Americans. They're not covering how, you know, Black Americans remain plagued by highest infant mortality and maternal mortality rates. They're not covering the impacts that the abortion ban is having on people who get pregnant and, you know, have and need a termination of their pregnancy. They are so they're focused on these things as a way to basically whip up anger and excitement from their listenership and their audience. And so I think we as independent journalists have to ask ourselves, if we sit there and try to correct everything that these folks are putting out there, what is the ultimate goal of what we want? Do we, you know, people are concerned about policy shift. They understand that Congress is gridlocked. They understand that Republicans have a slim majority in the House, and the Democrats have a slim majority in the Senate. All of that could be lost and flipped. So how do we change that, right? So the GOP has Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren Boebert and Jim Jordan and all of these pro-Trump, you know, really outrageously, you know, fundamentally flawed people that have entered Congress. Okay, so who do we have supporting progressive social justice change? We have Pramila Jayapal and Ro Khanna and Ted Lieu and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib. And that list is growing. We have Jamal Bowman. We have, you know, and how do we get that list to increase? So let's focus on the young crop of Democratic socialists that are infiltrating the Democratic Party so that we can push it to the left, not because we care about the Democrats being better than the Republicans. We care about not having, you know, fascism in our country, and we care about upholding social justice. And what is the path to that? And how do we then, as independent journalists, cover those news stories in a way that have an impact, in a way that actually generate excitement among our audiences, in a way that benefits democracy rather than suppressing democracy? Because the cynicism and the hopelessness that many Americans feel suppresses democracy. And that is precisely what Fox News wants.
Mm-hmm. You know, some of what you're saying points to another bigger topic that you might be tackling in your next book on economic justice. But the political economy of media in America is such that we as independent journalists and radio producers could produce the best things on the airwaves. And yet, due to the way the system is built, Hannity is on 500 radio stations 3 hours, 5 days a week. They got a big microphone.
Yeah, but look at the return on their investment. Okay, they have such a huge megaphone, right? They have so much money that they've poured into it. You would think that their ideas would be more popular than they are. They are not actually as popular as they would have been. If we had this a similar sized megaphone, we'd be looking at a radically different country, because the values that we are putting out and that we are uplifting are values that a majority of Americans and ordinary people are attracted to anyway. Because when you start talking to ordinary people about basic needs and fulfilling basic needs and the role of government, you find that you end up on the same side on a lot of issues. And the reason why these, you know, right-wing institutions are attacking critical race theory and affirmative action is because they work. They have been proven to work so well that there's a backlash, right? That is them showing their hand. They are losing the culture war, but it doesn't mean, of course, we sit on our laurels. It feels like a war sometimes, right? But how do we win it? Do we win it by getting more aggressive? We win it by centering joy. And I take my lead, and you know that sounds all like fluffy, but it isn't. I take my lead from Black American racial justice activists who, you know, may not be getting the same kind of corporate media coverage that they were 3 years ago because they're busy doing the work. Look at what Alicia Garza is doing with the Black Futures Lab. The Black Futures Lab. Look at the renaissance that Octavia Butler's science fiction is having, because she imagined a completely different world. That's narrative work, by the way, and inspired so many people to imagine themselves, so many Black and Brown people to imagine themselves in a radically different world. And a lot of the activists whose work I follow center joy, center, you know, the ideals that they want a future to be, they center them in the work they're doing now. That is something that is, you know, something that we move toward. If we can really articulate what it is that we're moving toward, people are going to join that, because everybody, you know, it's easy to convince people. It's easier than we think to convince people that we are on the right side of history. The reactionary forces have always been on the wrong side of history. And they want to bait us, and we cannot fall for their baiting. We cannot fall for them hysterically crying about all of the details about Hunter Biden's laptop and all of that. You know, like, seriously, just move past that. And let's talk about taking power, changing power, convincing our fellow Americans. I also write in the book about how deep canvassing and calling in as opposed to calling out methods and pools can really one by one by one, through person-to-person conversations, change the narratives around racial justice, around social justice in this country. And we can do it. We have to be invested in it, though. And we cannot be cynical anymore. We can't afford to be cynical anymore.
And indeed, we need some investment here in our community radio station, KGNU. This is just a short summer flash drive, but we're counting on you to give us a call, 303-449-4885. You can also just go to kgnu.org and make a small contribution. We're speaking with Sonali Kolhatkar here on KGNU. Sonali, again, your confidence about the inevitability of this positive change coming, I have to ask another personal question.
Yeah.
Maybe your parents are Gandhian in this way? Once you're on the moral right side of history, it's going to happen. Is that what's going on here too?
Have you been? No. My grandfather is probably the person whose legacy I may be sort of living. He was a founder of the Communist Party of India, Marxist. And but before I became politically active, involved, or unaware, he passed away. And my father was the opposite, is the opposite, became a capitalist and, you know, worked as an architect in Dubai. My mom worked for a local bank that was then bought out by HSBC, one of the biggest banks in the world, and she retired. Both my parents are now retired. Both my parents have no idea how they bore me and who I am. They thought they were, you know, raising a physicist, as I told them I was in my early teens. And then I told them I was now a journalist, and they are proud of me and they just watch me. And my mom's trying to read my book. She says the print is a little small for her, but she's reading it. But, you know, I have to say, I came to the United States at age 16 in part to learn about physics, but I was also drawn to the fact that I was at that time living in a country where I wasn't free to speak my mind. You know, the United Arab Emirates, one of the most liberal monarchies in the Gulf, but still a monarchy nonetheless. And there's a fear of the secret police being there at every turn. And if you criticize the monarchy, you can be deported. And I hated that. And it hit me at a gut level, very fundamental level. And I've been an immigrant all my life. I'm born in a country and was never, you know, the United Arab Emirates, you can't be a citizen, no matter if you're born there. So I knew if I was going to stay there, I was going to be an immigrant all my life who couldn't speak up. And one of the things that the United States promised was the ability to speak my mind and not be penalized for it. The freedom of speech thing, that ideal was very attractive. And I knew that, you know, I wanted to come here. I came all by myself at age 16. My parents were terrified of what was happening, but they were like, all right, I guess she knows what she's doing. And I kind of grew up on my own and I became very independent and I charted my own path. And I've every step of the way tried to live what I feel is the most important thing, which is a meaningful life. Right? What is it that we are living for? What is it that we are, you know, are we here to make money? Are we here to rise to the top? Are we here to exist? Are we here to do something powerful and meaningful? And I want to be able to do something powerful and meaningful. I call it the deathbed test. If on my deathbed, I can look back on my life and feel it's a life worth, you know, that was well lived, I passed the deathbed test. And that's it. That, you know, it's not Gandhian parents, although they were very much, you know, supporters of Gandhi. They're liberal minded, but they're not, you know, they don't know who I, like there are times when they're just like, we don't know how she happened to end up this way.
Well, we're really happy you wound up this way and that you're with us all the way, Sonali Kolhatkar. This has been a really wonderful conversation as we learn more about you. I had two other questions. Have you kept up with some developments in astrophysics and the astronomy? There's incredible.
Yeah, happening. No, I haven't. Look, my husband is still at Caltech and he works in the industry, in the field, rather. It's not even an industry, it's a science. And he works on the space telescopes. We were both working on, I was working on the Spitzer Space Telescope before I quit. I don't keep up with it. The science background, however, has been so useful as a journalist because science is about uncovering the truth, figuring out how things work, adjusting your hypotheses based on new evidence as it comes about, Journalism is very similar to that, except journalism is about storytelling. And as long as you stick with facts and the truth and don't try to bend the truth to suit your agenda, it is okay to have an agenda of social justice, because that is ultimately, you know, the point of journalism. It's meant to be a bulwark for democracy and against fascism. So, no, I don't keep up with what's happening in the science and in astrophysics per se, but I do use my science education and background every single day, because I don't have a degree in journalism. But I feel like, at this stage, I don't really need one.
Well, but you do still spend time practicing the ukulele?
Oh, right. Actually, yeah. And I picked up the bass. I've been playing bass guitar since last year. I'm an artist. You know, one of the things that I was doing a lot of, and I had to figure out why, I was a prolific artist. I mean, I still do a lot of art. But when I was working at KPFK, I was so traumatized by all the news that I constantly covered. The news cycle is especially like under Trump, right? I'm sure can relate. The news cycle and chasing the crisis, doom and gloom cycle of everything that's wrong in the world has a deeply traumatizing effect on journalists that we don't often talk about. And so I resorted to a lot of art therapy. And so I just like paint and sew and crochet and knit and pottery. I mean, you name the art form, I've probably tried it or thought about trying it. I don't do as much of it because I find that I'm not as like depressed about the world anymore. But yeah, no, I practice a lot of art. I hope everyone does. We need more creativity in this world because that's also where joy comes in. So I my husband and I are in a cover band and we play live music at fundraisers and we have fun because you have to.
That's great advice, because there are occupational hazards to becoming addicted to media, even independent media like KGNU. We do need to have fun with ourselves, with our families, with musicians, et cetera. As we close, I know how difficult it is to speak about race in America. It seems you've taken this issue front and center and with zest. And the only other person I know who can do this and make everybody like lighten up is the comedian you mentioned in the book, Hari Kondubolu.
Yeah, he's great.
Do you have a background with him, or what got you onto him?
I interviewed him about his film that he made, this documentary film about the Simpsons character, the Indian character, Apu, the racist stereotypical character that was played by a white guy. And Hari's great. I follow his work, and he is one of these folks who is engaged in narrative shifting. And in making that documentary, he challenged Hollywood perpetuating racist stereotypes. And because of what he did, because of him calling out Hank Azarian, I think is the name of the actor. I can't remember. Because of him calling out the makers of The Simpsons and the actor who voiced Apu's character, The Simpsons changed. And because of many others like Hari Kondubolu, Hollywood has been forced to shift. It isn't perfect, but it's doing better than it was. It's been forced to confront the fact that it has told white dominated stories from white dominated writers' rooms with white supremacist storylines for far too long. And creators of color like Hari, who's also creating content, are now able to change narratives in Hollywood and create these complex, nuanced, beautiful, powerful BIPOC characters, Black, Indigenous, people of color characters that showcase the fact that we are all complex human beings that are neither good or bad, that deserve the full spectrum of human rights, that we're not going to let you dehumanize us anymore and make us props for your white protagonists and help us be these sideshow minstrel characters to tell your story. And we're not going to tolerate the white savior trope anymore. We're not going to tolerate propaganda. I have a whole chapter on pro-police propaganda in Hollywood. And, we're rising up. We hope the rest of the country joins us.
What are you working on for your next program? What's the next one going to be about?
My next show, I just booked an expert to break down the affirmative action decision at the Supreme Court and talk about how the Supreme Court didn't actually end affirmative action. It just ended it for people of color. Legacy admissions are still intact. All of the affirmative action policies in place that have been in place for wealthy white folks in college admissions are still intact. So that's one story that I've already booked. And then I did a series of interviews at a reparations conference in Atlanta, Georgia, a few weeks ago for Yes Magazine. And we're rolling them out two a week. So two of the three interviews on my next show will be with elders from the reparations movement, Nkechi Taifa and Kenneth Henry, both of whom have laid the groundwork for the work that, you know, Ta-Nehisi Coates is doing now and the reparations movement. So, and, you know, reparations is a solution to confronting white supremacy, which is why I'm covering it. And I hope that our country can get behind reparations for Black Americans, because it is one path out of the racial problems that we find ourselves in and the struggle we're having with racial injustice.
I feel like I could talk to you I don't want to take up the whole afternoon, but in reading the book, the Copaganda section, I remember a lecture I attended by Amiri Baraka, and he talked about the same phenomena in film with glorifying the police. You mentioned Dragnet, I think, in 1951. He did a comparison of films where he looked at these gangster movies from the 20s and 30s with Edward G. Robinson, and these folks, they glorified the criminal. Mm-hmm. The Irish thief was always clever. There were deviants who were stars and were protagonists in the film. Amiri's theory was that when Ronald Reagan became president of the Screen Actors Guild, that began to change. They did begin glorifying military, police, militarism, et cetera. And it was a very engaging talk. A footnote that came up after reading your book.
Yeah, that I didn't realize that Amiri Baraka had written about that. Yeah, that's a great to know. But yeah, no, it's a big deal in Hollywood, and Hollywood still hasn't like confronted that aspect of itself. You know, it's like they've a little bit maybe I think started to think about it after 2020, but the thing that I point out in the book that isn't talked about even as much is that the Hollywood loves to cast Black folks as cops to justify police brutality. You can't be against cops. Cops are good people. Some are even Black, right? Like, look at, you know, it's like there's a disproportionate casting in Hollywood of police officers as Black, which is like very insidious, and victims of police brutality as white. Very insidious. Yeah. You know, this is liberal Hollywood, right? Yeah. Supposedly liberal Hollywood. And I live in Southern California, so I know a lot of the folks who are like part of the industry.
The portrayal of Arabs has been chronicled too. I knew Deepak Kumar.
Absolutely. Yeah.
What was her book? The Planet of the Arabs. She wrote
so many people have done some amazing work on that, right? Like, absolutely. Yeah. The Arab as terrorist, very much. Mm-hmm.
I'm going to send your warm regards to David when I see him tomorrow morning.
Oh, please. Yes, and absolutely.
We're rooting for you all the way, Sonali.
Thank you. I loved doing this. This was really lovely. Thanks so much for reaching out.
Okay, good luck making all your deadlines and getting back,
thank you.
To the ukulele.
Oh, thank you. All right, take care.
Will do.
Bye.
Bye-bye. We go out with Hari Kondubolu while taking the last few minutes for your calls right here at 303-449-4885. Thank you for your support, and thanks for listening to KGNU and Rising Up with Sonali every Wednesday at 4 o'clock. This has been Joe Ritchie.
When exactly did Halloween turn into racist Christmas? When did that happen? When did we decide it was okay to wear blackface and geisha costumes without getting slapped? Like, when did that happen? The newest thing I've noticed recently the last few years is white people wearing like Native American headdresses, right? To be fair, it's not just white people. It's also people of color who've chosen their side in the race war. So it'll be like headdresses and face paint and vests and moccasins. It's not even just one tribe. It's like a Mr. Potato Head of indigenous cultures mixed and matched like they don't mean anything. What bothers me the most is that if you're going to do an impression of Native Americans, at least do it right by being unjustifiably killed at the end. Make it your last Halloween. I know some people didn't like that in Portland because they were like, oh no, two Halloweens ago.
No, no.
He wants to kill my boyfriend. There's no minority to check us. No. So I was telling a friend my feelings about cultural appropriation and headdresses in particular. My friend's like, well, hurry to play devil's advocate. A white man invented basketball, and when I last checked, mostly black people play it. So why can't I wear a headdress? Genocide. That's why you can't wear a headdress. Genocide. First of all, why do people want to play devil's advocate, right? It's basically a phrase that you could hide behind to say whatever ish you want to say and pretend you're being objective, right? More importantly, why does the devil need an advocate? He's the devil. Why does the prince of darkness need your help? Like, what are you telling me is happening here exactly? Like, hey, Steve, it's me, the devil. I need your help right now. See that woman over there that's saying men and women should be paid equally in the workforce? Well, I want you to tell her, on my behalf, that she should shut the fuck. Because women take maternity leave that costs companies money, so she should shut up. Tell her that, on my behalf. That is not what's happening here. It's just something you could hide behind so you don't look as bad, which is weird because how doesn't it make you look bad to hide behind the devil? No, Steve's not a... He just does Satan's bidding. That's all. I talk about race a lot in my act, which I know makes a lot of white people uncomfortable. Actually, you know what? It's not even the discussion of race that makes white people uncomfortable. It's just me using the phrase white people. I don't think white people are used to being named like the rest of us, I think. Because I'm sure there's somebody in here that's like, oh, he's saying white people. Is he talking about me? He's saying white people, so he must be talking about me. If you think I'm talking about you, then yeah, I'm definitely talking about you. Absolutely. Absolutely. Because the cool white people in this room and the people of color know what I'm talking about. I'm talking about white people. I'm not talking about white people. Yeah, you get it. Some of you know what I'm saying. Some of you think I'm dog whistling right now. What does he mean? Is this some kind of code? Are we safe? What's going on here? It's kind of a code. It's kind of a code. It's like an in term for people who say white people. It's another way of saying white privilege or white supremacy or the unfairness because of race. It's a term we use and we know what it means. But I realize it's confusing because, you know, the phrases are the same. So from now on, cool white people, people of color, don't use the phrase white people, okay? From now on, use the phrase white demons. Because nobody's going to think they're a demon. That's not going to confuse anybody, you know? And this country was built on white demonry, right? All the people on the money, pilgrims, Columbus, CEOs of most major corporations, Oscar voters, like all white demons, right? I'm sure there's somebody in here who's thinking, hurry, are you saying all white people are demons? Are you saying all demons are white people? Of course there are non-white demons. Robert Mugabe, president of Zimbabwe, he is a non-white demon. It's weird. I get called politically correct by people who don't like me. And they're like, you're so politically correct. What kind of comic is so politically correct? Politically correct. I just call white people demons. And the people who like me can be equally annoying because they'll say stuff like, I love you because you're not offensive. You're the only comedian I know that's not offensive. I am offensive to demons.